The Spitfire was a masterpiece of British engineering. But even masterpieces have room for improvement. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and this is Spitfire, the people's plane. This story is about a problem buried deep in the complex engine of the Spitfire, and it starts in the heat of battle. A dogfight, 20,000 feet above the south coast of England. In the Spitfire cockpit is RAF flying ace Douglas Bader.
And the ideal way to shoot another airplane down is to be going at the same speed, 200 yards behind him.
Right on his tail is a Messerschmitt 109, the jewel in the crown of the German Luftwaffe. It's man versus man, machine versus machine. The skill of the pilots and the precision engineering of the mighty aircraft both have a role to play.
Most of us, it was purely the aeroplane we wanted to get rid of. We didn't care a bit whether the chap inside he got out or whether he was killed.
The pilot knows exactly what his Spitfire is capable of. He pulls back the stick, forcing the plane into a tight corkscrew turn. It's too much for the Messerschmitt. It can't quite follow. Robert Stanford Tuck, another British flying ace, demonstrates what's going on.
Now, the Spitfire has a remarkably good rate of turn, better than the Messerschmitt. Now, as they're turning steeply, the Messerschmitt can't turn as quickly as the Spitfire, so therefore, all his shots are going astern here.
That's 1-0 to the Spitfire. The pilot swoops round in a tight arc to find himself on the German's tail. The enemy is in his sights. He lines up, ready to fire, when suddenly...
My immediate evasive action would be just to stick my nose straight down as fast as I could and accelerate away.
The 109 dives steeply, hurtling towards the ground. The pilot tries to give chase, sticks his nose down into a dive too, but there's a problem.
So when I push the stick forward, all the petrol flow goes away from the carburetor and the airplane goes...
Bang.
All this sort of banging and so on, and things come out from the bottom of the cockpit, you know, the spanners, the people left on the floor and so on, and dust and stuff. That is no good.
In a steep dive, the Spitfire's engine splutters and loses power just when you need it most. The Spitfire can't handle the dive, and the German pilot knows it. He makes his escape, and that's one all. So what's going on? The key to the Spitfire is the engine, the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. But it has this one potentially fatal flaw.
That's a Merlin. You're looking at one of the early Merlin engines here. Three-bladed propeller on the front, you can see there. Big engine, as you can see, with 12 cylinders.
Donald Spears was a civilian engineer with the Ministry of Defence for many years. Now he's the vice chairman of the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum.
The fuel's coming in, it's been supercharged and blown in along the manifolds here.
This problem, the power cutting out in a steep dive, can be traced back to a small but essential part of the engine, called the carburetor.
It simply gets the fuel out of the petrol tank and puts it into the engine. It's basically just a little chamber, usually about 3 or 4 inches high, with a float that goes up and down. Then the engine sucks fuel out from the bottom, the float comes down and more fuel comes in at the top.
This float system in the carburetor makes sure the engine always has the right amount of fuel. But the problem is, it needs gravity in order to work properly. Something you can pretty much take for granted in a car, but that gets a little less reliable in a mid-air dogfight. You could be upside down or racing towards the ground in a steep dive, and suddenly you're in negative G. The fuel sloshes about, and the carburetor's clever little float simply stops working. One minute, the engine is starved of fuel. The next, it's flooded.
All of that made the engine misfire, if you like, and lose power, which was not what you wanted when you were trying to chase a German Messerschmitt across the sky.
This problem needs fixing, and the Ministry of Aircraft Production take it right to the top, to the best research facility in the country. It's called the RAE, the Royal Aircraft Establishment. It was the best of the best. A place where the finest minds in British engineering could devote themselves to perfecting every part of Britain's aircraft. The Spitfire problem lands on the desk of the head of the carburetor section, and in 1940, that job was occupied by a fairly extraordinary person. Standing 5 foot 1 inch tall, with thick glasses and a stern expression behind which the occasional flicker of a wicked humour could be seen. And the extraordinary thing, even in wartime, was she was a woman. A woman called Beatrice, known to everyone respectfully as Miss Schilling.
Now in those days, there weren't any lady engineers. Might as well be a lady lion tamer, you know, couldn't do it.
Beatrice Schilling grew up in Kingston-upon-Thames, now a part of London.
My dad was a butcher, so quite working class kind of upbringing. I'm Jo Denbury and I am the great niece of Beatrice Schilling.
From a very young age, it was clear that Bea, as the family called her, was different.
As a child, I played with Meccano and spent my pocket money on penknives, a glue pot, an adjustable spanner and other such simple hand tools. When I was 16 years old, I bought a small second-hand two-stroke motorcycle. I got a lot of pleasure from dismantling and rebuilding this motorcycle, and my parents recognised that I had some mechanical skill.
When Beatrice wanted to study engineering and the school said, well, I'm sorry, women don't do engineering, it was her mother who encouraged her to continue with her education, which was quite outstanding, I suppose, for a woman in those days.
Beatrice got a place on an electrical engineering apprenticeship while still in her teens and learned to wire up everything from domestic houses to entire power stations. And in 1929, she applied to the University of Manchester to do an engineering degree. No woman had ever done it before. But that didn't stop her.
I registered as a first-year student. It was a very pleasant surprise to find another woman, Sheila McGuffey, had also registered as a first-year student. We two women students were a slight embarrassment to the engineering department at times. On a boiler trial in hot weather, for example, the normal state of undress of the stokers was rapidly abandoned when it was remembered that women were present.
Although perhaps she was a little bit intimidating, she was also very encouraging. And she always had a slight twinkle in her eye, you know, she had a sense of humour.
In between her studies, Bea carried on tinkering with motorbikes. She was never happier than with her head buried deep in a deconstructed engine spread out on the living room floor.
I suppose my earliest memory was probably going to her house. I think she was about 60. But you'd go in through the side because the sitting room was turned into a kind of mechanics workshop, I suppose. And I always remember the smell, which was the smell of oil. And in there, you know, there would be bits of engines and carburetors and vices, you know, on the side of a table where something was being worked on. But it wasn't really your standard front room.
Her love for motorbikes never abated, and she began racing competitively at a private racecourse called Brooklands. It was full of like-minded enthusiasts and petrol heads like her.
As soon as women were permitted to race motorcycles at the Brooklands racetrack, I started to look at motorcycles which were suitable for racing. I bought a demonstration model 500cc International Norton. I modified the engine, increased the inlet valve and port diameters, and was placed several times, winning one race from scratch.
Brooklands had a coveted award, the Gold Star, for anyone who pulled off the extraordinary speed of 100 miles per hour. In 1934, on a hot race day in August, Bea screamed round the track at 101 and into the Gold Star Hall of Fame, only the second woman in history ever to do so. By the time she graduated, it was the mid-1930s, and in between bike races, Bea was job hunting. Prospects were few and far between, long waits in corridors only to be laughed at or dismissed, letters of rejection addressed formulaically to Dear Sir. One interviewer even disparaged her racing record, sneering that the men probably let her win. It was a dispiriting time. But her determination paid off in 1936, when she secured a junior position at the Royal Aircraft Establishment. It was to be the start of a distinguished 35-year career.
I was offered a job as an assistant in the technical publications department. The Air Ministry, having had some experience of women's work in the First World War, were not entirely unsympathetic. I spent the next 8 months or so writing aero engine handbooks. I then managed to get transferred to the engine department, where I found the familiarity with the detailed construction of several engines I had acquired raised my standing in the workshops.
It was at the RAE that she bumped into a smiling, strikingly handsome mathematician called George Naylor. He also raced bikes, although he wasn't nearly as fast as Bea.
George was this kind of really nice, very tall, quite handsome, gentle guy. Very patient, easygoing, whiskey glass in hand kind of guy. Who let her get on, do what she wanted to do. But he adored her, worshipped her, that was very clear.
Beatrice believed in a marriage of equals. She told him that once he got a gold star of his own, she would marry him, and not before. It took him 2 years of time trials, but in 1938, he flew round the Brooklands track, winning himself the coveted gold star and an even more coveted new wife.
And she was quite cheeky. My mum would tell me stories. For example, they would go on car rallies with friends and she would do pranks on him, like she'd put a pair of French knickers in the glove box and then get her friend to find them. Ooh, what are these? And she'd wind him up saying, oh, girlfriend, you know. So she'd play pranks on him. They had that kind of relationship.
When the war separated them, George flying Lancaster bombers and Beatrice engineering aircraft, they wrote to each other often, as couples do, about everything and nothing. About spiders under the sink.
There are plenty of pockets of resistance in this house, so I decided a flamethrower was the only thing for under the sink.
They reminisced about their childhoods.
I was ticked off many times a day at school. If you could establish that if you got ticked off, you burst into tears, you could get away with anything.
Shared the challenges of their work.
We're trying to get extra fuel through a carb and have it ready for fitting to an aircraft at 8 a.m. tomorrow. Needless to say, it is 11 p.m. and some silly bloke has switched everything off because I took the troops out for some beer at 9:45.
And shared their moments of fun too.
4 double whiskies and some beer plus a 5-shilling brandy. Anyway, I have ridden a push bike home more or less straight.
And in amongst the daily updates, the occasional achingly tender love letter too.
Darling, it is a shocking business, this being separated. I haven't seen you for 18 days. It is too long. All my love. Darling B.
By the time the Spitfire engine problem landed on her desk, Beatrice was head of the carburetor section at RAE, with a small team under her. They got to work immediately.
She would have had a test bench with rigs, so she could have a hydraulic pump and pump fuel through along a pipe. It would all be done by almost trial and error, you know.
For 19 hours a day, they tested and tried and prodded and poked at possible solutions. Fuel pressure and temperature, altitude, the steepness of the dive, all had to be accounted for. In the spring of 1941, around a year after starting work on the problem, Beatrice had her solution.
She came up with a solution which was really just a tiny washer which you put in the fuel pipe which stopped the sudden surge of fuel. It is very simple, really.
A metal ring no bigger than a fingernail with a carefully chamfered inner edge.
And that's all it does. It's a very simple concept. Couldn't be simpler, really. You just put something in the way to stop it coming so fast. I mean, it's so simple and yet so clever.
Sir Stanley Hooker, legendary mathematician and jet engine engineer, was working with Rolls-Royce at the time. Both Rolls-Royce and RAE had been working on a solution. But it was Beatrice who got there first.
A famous lady engineer from the Royal Aircraft Establishment, Miss Schilling, she put a small thing about the size of a penny with a hole through it, and we called it Miss Schilling's orifice, I remember at the time.
Which I suppose is the sort of bawdy thing that people did in those days. I mean, it's a very sort of crude thing you would expect from the lads on the station in those days. Oh, let's have a look at her orifice, you know. She would have just dismissed it as being rather stupid.
The washer is more properly called the RAE restrictor, but the joke name, the bawdy double entendre, really stuck. Miss Schilling's orifice was what it became known as, although never to her face.
My take on it is it is quite derogatory, but I suspect that her view was a little bit of eye-rolling and shrugging it off. I don't think she would have found it funny remotely. I suspect she would have just rolled her eyes and thought, boys will be boys.
The next problem was how to get this tiny washer into every Spitfire in the country. Beatrice wasn't about to trust something so important to anyone else. She delivered them all herself.
She then got a team together and went round to all the RAF stations, helping them fit it into their aircraft. And it cured the problem almost entirely.
She did this in her usual style, at enormous speed. On her trusty Norton, with a bag of tools on the back and a sack full of orifices to distribute to the mechanics at base.
Oh yes, she drove a motorbike around. She didn't just drive it round Brooklyn, she used it as a method of transport to and from work.
The RAE restrictor did the job. The dogfighting pilots, risking their lives thousands of feet up, could swoop and dive with no loss of power to the engine, which gave them the edge in the great battle in the sky. By her retirement in 1969, she was aware of the doors she and others like her had opened, but was also aware there was more still to do.
Many women were recruited by the Royal Aircraft Establishment. By the end of the war, practically all posts in the scientific service were open to single women. Equal pay, introduced over 7 years, followed. Prejudice against women is dying fast in Britain. However, while women engineers have won parity with men, there is a fight for all professional engineers in Britain if the present excellence of our engineering is to be maintained.
Without Miss Schilling, the Spitfire would never have been able to keep up in the furious arms race between the British and German planes.
I think it's one of these most iconic aircraft we've ever seen. But I mean, becoming a female engineer at that time was a big struggle for her, there's no doubt about it. She led the way, undoubtedly. She led the way.
Next time, we look again at the production of the Spitfire at a brand new factory, but one that very nearly didn't produce a single plane.
After an explosion in space, now it's the climax of the rescue mission. Can the astronauts be brought home safely?
What could we have missed?
This can't be happening.
You could hear a pin drop.
"13 Minutes to the Moon" from the BBC World Service, the final episode. Available now.